It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you are a reader or love someone who is, it's time to get ready. This hour, we'll get recommendations for some of the best new books for giving and receiving this holiday season from some of Iowa's finest independent booksellers. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to focus on books for young readers. But today is our day, books for grown-ups today. Jan Weissmuller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City are here. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Charity.
And Tim, hello.
Good morning.
And Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. Welcome back to the show, Hunter.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And I want to start with fiction. We've got fiction picks. Jan picked a poetry book, as she always does, which is wonderful. And then we'll do some nonfiction a little bit later in the hour. But let's start with fiction picks. And Tim, why don't you kick us off with your first pick of the day?
There are so many great African-American writers out there. So I want to start with one of these books, The Water Dancer by Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's his first novel. People might remember that name from his National Book Award winner, Between the World and Me. And The Water Dancer is set in Virginia, pre-Civil War, and is the story of Hiram Walker, a slave in bondage who escapes and becomes a member of the Underground Railroad and works as an agent to free other slaves. It is beautifully written. And I tell you, Charity, if we read more books like this, I think it inspires so much empathy in the reader for the plight of people at that time and the African-American population as a whole. And the big crux of it is the separation from family, that, you know, parents, children were sold, were taken away from them, and how they live with that and the bonds they form with other people in the same situation to make up for that loss of family. There's a hint of magical realism to it, as Hiram has a special power that is one of the reasons he's enlisted into the Underground Railroad. But it is a beautiful, moving, really mind-opening novel, and I would recommend it very strongly.
All right. Starting off strong, The Water Dancer by Ta-Nehisi Coates. And Jan, I'll let you go next.
Well, I'm going to talk about Ann Patchett's new novel, The Dutch House, which is, it's a strange novel. It has this sort of overshadow of maybe Shirley Jackson, because the Dutch House has this presence. And the house itself is a house that a self-made millionaire buys for his wife, who hates it because she's too concerned about poverty to want to live in this house. And the people that had owned it lost a fortune and left everything in it. And so he marries a man. The wife leaves the husband with these two little children, and marries another woman who basically figures out how to get rid of these kids. And so then the story is really just about how the rest of their lives unravel after they've been exiled from the Dutch house. And it's a very interesting book. I mean, Ann Patchett is always a good writer, so you can always...
Right, you can count on her.
You can count on her to write something that's engaging. And I heard her do an interview where she talked about wanting to write a book about income, you know, income gap. And it's very subtle in that respect, I think. I mean, a little bit, maybe not in terms of the mother who leaves for that reason, but just in terms of the two siblings and how they negotiate having been wealthy and no longer being wealthy. It's pretty subtle. And their bond is very strong and very interesting. There's actually 6 years difference in their ages, and so the sister is older, and she sort of mothers the boy, Danny, who ends up going to medical school but not practicing medicine.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
It sounds a little bleak.
I guess I'm making it sound bleaker than it is. I it's not really funny,
right,
ever, but it's not bleak in that they're so close and that their bond gives them strength through a lot of things.
Okay. So exploring those relationships and feeling for those people doesn't leave you feeling crushed.
No. He becomes a father, and his relationship with his children is interesting given his background. And
All right. So The Dutch House by Ann Patchett. And I am sure a lot of people are excited about that. She has such incredibly loyal fans. Hunter, what's your first fiction pick?
The first one I had was The Lost Children Archive by Valeria Luiselli. And it is a migration story. And so a family starts off in New York, and they are driving to the Southwest where the Apaches lived. And while they are driving is when the start of the child migration crisis happens. And so you kind of get snippets of that, like on the radio or on the TV when they get to the motels that they're staying at. And so then it's the kind of the parents trying to, you know, they're just trying to take all of this in, you know, and they have two kids. And but then at the same time, they're traveling. And so then you kind of get all of the stuff that happens when you're traveling with two kids, and the both of the kids get a lot of page time, and I think that they do a good job of just sort of, they're not just like a token characters, they really kind of are fully fleshed out, and the book itself is also kind of an archive, and it's divided into boxes, like in sections, and each of the boxes will contain like notebooks and books and folders and stuff like that, which I enjoyed, kind of as a reading experience.
So, I mean, actually, physically in the book, are there things you open?
It's just lists. So it'll be like, okay, instead of having like part one, part two, it'll have different divided up into kind of boxes. And then at the start of each of those will be like an inventory of which each box contains. And they're moving, they're going down to the Pedreria because they, for work related things, and they're both like documentarians. And so it's kind of also have to do with their work as well. So you get a lot of the kind of the history of the American, like the Southwest and the Apaches and stuff like that, while also sort of taking in like the current crisis of the child migration crisis. And then at the same time, yeah, having these kids getting a lot of page time, which is what I enjoyed most.
Right. Well, and it is, now that you say that, I think it's interesting because so often children are not fleshed out as full people and characters. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you spend time with children, they're people, not necessarily in books, but in real life. So that sounds fascinating. Lost Children Archive by Valeria Luiselli. And that brings us back to you, Tim.
The second novel I will choose is called This Tender Land by William Kent Kruger. And listeners might recognize his name because he's written a series of mysteries. But he's done two standalone novels now, and this is his latest one. This Tender Land is set in 1932 Minnesota. So it's a beautifully written about the Depression. And it's set in a Native American school for children. And I wasn't aware of this, that you know, the government had children removed from reservations to learn English and to kind of leave behind their Native American ways. And it focuses on four children at this school. Two are white, who are orphans, who happen to end up here, brothers, Odie and Albert. And because of the situation at the school, the people that run the school are either exploitative at best or abusive at worst, and circumstances force them to flee. So the two brothers leave with another Native American child who was 16, the oldest brother 16, and then a 12-year-old, Odie. And then they also take a neighbor girl who's an orphan suddenly, who's only about 6 or 7. And they decide to travel by canoe from Minnesota down to St. Louis because a teacher told them that the Gilead River flows into the Minnesota, which flows into the Mississippi, which will take you all the way to the ocean. It is told in hindsight, and the narration is a little bit like the narrator from The Waltons, if people remember that old TV show. Very soothing, very simply told, and it's really just an odyssey of four children trying to make their way down a river in a canoe, and some people help them, some people want to get in their way and endanger them. And it's really a story just about family and belonging. It's a long novel. It's a great one to cuddle up with in the winter. And because it's set here in the Midwest, it's a lot of fun to read. As they talk about Dubuque or St. Louis or the Twin Cities in Depression times.
All right.
So it's a lovely, lovely story.
So a fiction, but it also, as you were saying, introduced you to part of our true history that you were not as familiar
with. That's correct. And a lot of the Depression stuff is, you know, just the language they use. I've got the goods on you. I mean, just phrases you don't hear that are just sort of fun in a nostalgic
a
sort of way.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. All right. This Tender Land by William Kent Kruger. And Jan, we are back to you.
Well, I'm going to talk about a collection of short stories by Peter Orner, who is yet another graduate of the Writers' Workshop,
yes.
I think. But he's been, I think, from the 90s. He was probably from there in the 90s. And it's called Maggie Brown and Others. And many of them are very short, although there's one really long one that's more like a novella. And they're sort of poetic. I mean, not in the language, because the language is very street language, but the situations feel sort of poetic to me because so much is unsaid. I mean, there's one story where these two high school kids drive up to like a swimming hole in the mountains, and they run into, when they get there, when they park, they run into a pregnant woman whose car is broken down. She's very pregnant, and she has no way to get home, and so they tell her they're going to swim. They don't want to give up their swim, but then they'll take her home. And they stay in longer than they thought they would. They get into this whole thing in the swimming hole. And when they get back, she's gone. And it's a mystery that haunts them for the rest of their lives. She's never found. Was this their fault? And many of the stories have that kind of sort of just eerie quality that I guess I think of as poetic. You were asking me if I thought the Dutch House was dark, and I said no. Maybe I just have a very high tolerance for darkness, but and I don't think of these as dark either.
But they do sound like the kind of thing that once you read it, maybe it comes back to you a couple weeks later, and you find yourself thinking about
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah. There's another one about a man whose wife had a long lingering illness, and after she dies, he marries a much younger woman. And there are all these pictures of his wife up in the house. And all of her family is very upset about that. But she somehow is comforted by these pictures, and sort of her identity sort of switches back and forth with this woman.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a
yeah.
big Peter Orner fan. This sounds very intriguing. Maggie Brown and Others by Peter Orner, a short story collection. We will be back in just a moment with more recommendations for some of the best new books. Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City are here, along with Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about the best new books for giving or receiving this holiday season with some of Iowa's independent booksellers. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to focus on books for young readers. Today, we're talking about books for grown-ups. And of course, this list will go up online later this afternoon as well. With me today, Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City, and Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. And Hunter, it's your turn for your next fiction pick.
So for the next one I had was The Dishwasher by Stéphane Leroux, who's a French-Canadian author, and the book takes place in Montreal. And it opens with a young man that has a gambling addiction, and he's sort of moving out from it with his roommate in the dead of night because he owes him a bunch of money that he hasn't been able to pay. And then he moves in with another friend and gets a job at an upscale restaurant in Montreal. And the sort of the descriptions of all of the chaos of the kitchen during rushes and of the dish pit and how, you know, something always goes wrong and how they're able to kind of work around it was just great. And then also just because it takes place in Montreal, they're always talking about descriptions of snow. And the snow gets a lot of page time on talking about how it sounds under, you know, when they're driving and, you know, as it's falling and the piles of it and stuff like that. And then he's, you know, will go out with his colleagues after they close the restaurant to the bar, and the bar will have slot machines and stuff, and you can just kind of feel the pull that these machines have on him. And so it's sort of him trying to come out of his gambling addiction. But the descriptions of the kitchen are kind of what really pulled it together for me, and the food and all of that.
Oh, interesting. So it's kind of like a visceral experience, it sounds like, with the deep descriptions of the weather and the chaos in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
All right. Dishwasher Stéphane Leroux. And we're back to you, Tim.
My next novel is called, unfortunately, Tuesday Mooney Talks to Ghosts by Kate Reculia. And I don't like the title because it gives you the idea that this is some sort of a horror novel. Tuesday Mooney is the main character. She's a 30-something who has the most interesting job. She is a researcher for a hospital, but she researches the money. So she's looking for people who have a connection to the hospital or wealthy people in town who might want to donate to the hospital financially rather than organ. She is just the cleverest, most witty, interesting woman in a book I've read in a long time. And she's pretty savvy tech-wise. She's much a loner. She grew up in Salem, Massachusetts. The novel is set in Boston. And her parents ran, of course, a gift shop around the witchcraft craze. So she has a tendency to be kind of like the daughter in Beetlejuice, always wearing black, always into horror movies, just because she's grown up with it. And the crux of the story is that she's attending a fundraising auction for the hospital, and an eccentric billionaire has an aneurysm and dies during this charity auction while bidding on tickets to meet the backstage boys or the Backstreet Boys in a concert, the reunion concert in Boston.
What a terrible way to go.
Yes, exactly. But he has left a treasure hidden in Boston and has left clues around the city. So Tuesday kind of asked for the help of four of her friends. She doesn't really have many friends. One is a 12-year-old girl who lives in the apartment next door to her with her father. And they go around the city trying to find this hidden treasure. Now, the millionaire has left clues based on Edgar Allan Poe. So there's a literary twist to it. It's a very witty, clever, funny, fast-paced urban adventure. And all the characters are probably, except for the billionaire and his wife, are probably, you know, under 40. So it's a good read for a younger reading audience. And the four people that Tuesday and her three cohort, they've all lost a person in their life. They all are a little bit wounded. And going through this adventure together and finding the meaning of friendship really helps them sort of, mature not only by themselves, but as a group together. It is just a really fun, enjoyable read. It's a gas.
All right. Super quirky. Tuesday Mooney Talks to Ghosts by Kate Reculia. And that brings us back to you, Jan.
Well, I'm gonna talk about this novel by the Nobel Prize winner, the woman who was shared the Nobel Prize with Peter Handke, which was a very contentious choice, I guess, this year. But anyway, her name is Olga Tokarczuk, I think.
All right. And that's how we will say it.
And this novel is called Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead. And it's set in a Polish village that's sort of a high up in the mountains where the weather is not good in the winter. And so many of the people just are summer people, and then they leave, for better climates in the winter. And the main character, Jamin, stays and takes care of these houses for these wealthy people, all of whom have weird stories. And she's an astrologer, and she's also a translator of Blake. And someone who takes a lot of comfort in her own company. And
that's a wonderful description. All right.
And and she has a reclusive neighbor, sort of a hermit that she doesn't really spend any time with. But she is outside one morning and finds a dead man and has to engage her neighbor in trying to help her discover. So it's a thriller, but it's got a lot of room for, moving back into reflection and these little experiences in the homes of these wealthy people, one of whom is a writer. And there are little epithets from Blake.
Oh, okay.
Throughout the book.
Yeah. Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga Tokarczuk. Didn't say it as well as you did, Jan, but you can find it at your local bookstore. Hunter, back to you.
So next I had the On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. And this, he's was previously his first novel, but he's published works of poetry before. And so this book, he does a lot of interesting things structurally because of that. And then, of course, the writing in it is beautiful. And you can kind of tell that he was, you know, a poet before. But it's very autobiographical and tells the story of Little Dog. And it opens as a letter to his mother. And they're both, you know, they're Vietnamese immigrants coming to America and grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. And it just kind of tells about the them, you know, the Asian American immigrant story. And his mother comes over after when he was just a baby. And so then he has grown up, has spent his whole entire life in America. And so then you kind of also get the divide between him and his mother culturally. And then Little Dog is also gay, and so then it's him kind of dealing with his sexuality and stuff like that. And then throughout the writing in it is absolutely beautiful.
So you would call it an autobiographical novel? Is that?
I think that's, yeah.
Okay.
Would be fair to say. And there's a lot of stuff. If you've read his poetry collection, it's a lot of the same themes and stuff that are in that are in his novel as well. And I mean, yeah, there's too much overlap for it to be. It would be sort of the, what do they call it? Autofiction.
Okay. All right. On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous, Ocean Vuong. And Tim, back to you.
Okay. The next book I'm going to talk about is a horror novel. I always have to put one horror in this group just for those of us who enjoy it.
Many, many people do.
This is called The Remaking by Clay McLeod Chapman. And the basic premise of the story is that in 1931, in a small town in Virginia, a woman and her daughter were accused of witchcraft because of a home remedy that went bad. And the vigilantes in town burned her, tied her to a tree and burned her. And the little girl was killed also. So that's the basic premise of the story. But what is so fascinating about this book is that it starts in the 50s. With a camp counselor relating this story around the campfire to a bunch of campgoers. So it's become an urban legend over these years. And then we jump to 1970s, when one of those children has grown up and lives in Hollywood and wants to make a film of the story. So it's a very low budget kind of hippie 70s kind of story. But then, you know, there's a lot of truth to some of these old legends. And of course, the film does not end well. It becomes a cult classic because of all the supernatural and all the stuff that happens around that movie. So in 1995, a fan of the cult classic is now going to make a remake of the movie. The little girl that starred in the 70s movie as the child is now old enough and has kind of a wrecked life because of this classic movie. They've enlisted to play the mother in the remake. Again, there's supernatural things that happen. This does not go well. And so finally, it ends up as a podcast with someone trying to get to the very center part of all this mythology. Yeah. So it has moments of pure terror in it. I will say it is very chilling. But the idea that this story has warped over the generations and years and been picked up and retold in different formats is really, really fascinating.
And that must make it feel even more real. That sounds very plausible.
It does.
Make a podcast out of
it. Of course they would. And the guy is determined to just bust all these myths about this story. But you know what? Sometimes you can't bust the myth when there's a real ghost involved.
All right. That sounds super creepy.
Yeah.
The Remaking by Clay McLeod Chapman. And you have one fiction pick left. I'm putting you guys on notice. You've got two left, Jan, and two for you, Hunter. So I know that you have a few extra, Hunter. You'll have to pick the two that you most want to talk about. And Jan, you get to go next.
Well, I'm going to do actually another collection of short stories.
All right.
And it's called The Usual Uncertainties by Jonathan Blum. And he is a really unusual writer. I mean, I don't really even know how to describe his style. I mean, it's very, very dry. But also very, very funny, but you're not even sure that you're aware that he's aware that it's funny.
You have to assume that he does know, but
yes, yes.
It sounds like it makes you feel very clever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a story that's all told. I mean, it's all told in an email. The entire story is an email that this guy is sending to a woman that he had went on one date with from an online dating thing, and it's really funny.
Oh, wow.
But
I'm already cringing.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so the collection, The Usual Uncertainties by Jonathan Blum. And Hunter, what's your next pick?
That'll be Lights All Night Long by Lydia Fitzpatrick. And this book opens with Elijah comes to America as part of a exchange program from Russia. And then when he gets here, his brother Vladimir is still is in jail in Russia. And so then the rest of the story is kind of told in is told using flashback and kind of tells the story of how Elijah would, you know, kind of the rise of Elijah to be able to come over here and how hard he works to, you know, like learn English and study in school and stuff so that he can come to America. And then at the same time, his brother Vladimir is kind of falling into the wrong crowd and doing drugs and stuff like that. And then when Elijah gets to America, he's trying to solve he's trying to free his brother from prison, who he's sure is in there
is innocent.
Is innocent, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of just get this back and forth. So it kind of has the flavor of a mystery, but it's still the writing in it's really good. It's in kind of eastern Russia, so it's a smaller town in Russia, and so you kind of get a lot of the descriptions of the post-Soviet life. And then again, the snow is just insane. They're talking about people losing their cars in it, and they just have to wait until it melts, and then they all go out and try and find where they parked their cars. But it was really good, yeah.
All right, Lights All Night Long, Lydia Fitzpatrick. And Tim, your final fiction pick, and we'll have to be brief.
My last choice is a book called A Cosmology of Monsters by Sean Hamill, a first novel from a workshop graduate. It is more of a fantasy than horror, despite the title, and it is the story of a family that is haunted by a monster over generations. And what I loved about this book, there's a blurb on the front from Stephen King that said, if John Irving ever wrote a horror novel, it would be something like this. And the family is really the main center, and they are endearing, charming, wonderful people. Noah, the youngest member of the family, befriends the monster, the only one who does, and has a lifelong relationship with it. It is really well written, has an incredibly satisfying ending, and the thing that's most interesting is whether the monster is drawn to the family because of their darkness. They have issues, depression and some other things, or whether the family is made this way by the presence of this monster on the periphery of their life. There's no horror in this novel. It's not scary. It is just the weirdness of having a beast that is somehow influencing your family or is being influenced by your family over generations. It's fascinating.
All right. A Cosmology of Monsters by Sean Hamill. And you have a poetry pick, Jan.
I do. Yeah.
Wonderful.
I have a poetry pick. And it is called To the Wren, and it's the collected poems of Jane Mead, who was my partner at Prairie Lights, who passed away in September. And it's the complete volumes of her 5 books of poetry plus some new poems. And I love having people come into Prairie Lights and look at her poems with me, whether they buy them or not. And I have all the poems in single volumes too, and I know them all very well, and they're very different. Each book is very different. I mean, her first book was sort of a confessional narrative book about her childhood, and her second book was more abstract but also sort of about that subject. And then her third book became, I think, what she is, which is an elegiac poet. I mean, her father, her family had this property in California for many years, and she sort of molds the landscape and the memories and the family histories in just an incredibly beautiful way.
All right. That sounds wonderful. To the Wren, Collected and New Poems by Jane Mead. And we have about a minute, Hunter. What's your final fiction pick, very briefly?
It's Red at the Bone by Jacqueline Woodson. And it's just kind of opens with Melody, who's the product of a teenage pregnancy. And then it kind of just bounces back and forth in time and tells kind of the family history. And her pregnancy kind of brings together two families from different classes. And then it just kind of talks about class and race and time and all of that. And It's very short, so it's impressive that she's able to do all that she does in like less than 200 pages. So.
And this is one of maybe only three books that Jacqueline Woodson has written for adults?
Yeah, I think. So, it might just be two even.
All right. And her children's books are remarkable. I'm glad you picked this one, Hunter. I'm a huge fan. I'm very excited. This is on my Christmas list. Red at the Bone by Jacqueline Woodson. And we are going to take a short break. We'll be back to talk about nonfiction books in just a moment. Again, Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City are here. Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. We've talked about our fiction picks today, and these will all go up online by the end of the day. So if you haven't gotten things written down or if you've forgotten a title, don't worry. It will be there later on in the nonfiction picks as well. And then tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about books for young readers. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about some of the best new books for giving and receiving this holiday season. There are so many best books that, of course, we can't talk about all of them. But we have asked some of Iowa's independent booksellers to pick some of their favorites. Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City are here, along with Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. And it's time to shift gears to nonfiction. And we only have a short time, so we're going to try to be fairly brief with all of these nonfiction picks. I know that's a challenge. But Tim, I'll let you go first.
The first one is a memoir by Françoise Frankl called A Bookshop in Berlin. And this was a book that was published in 1944 and kind of fell away, disappeared, and someone has rediscovered it. It has an introduction by Patrick Modiano, who was the French Nobel Prize winner a few years ago. And it is her. She had a bookstore, a French language bookstore in Berlin in the 20s and 30s, and then, of course, had to abandon that bookshop in 1939 because of the Nazis. And then really just recounts her trying desperately to leave Berlin. She goes to France for a while and then trying to get to Switzerland. And because it's written in 44, it seems all very fresh. She's not writing it from an older woman looking back, but she was in her 50s on her own. And, you know, there's moments of incredible cruelty and moments of incredible kindness by people along this way. I just found it's simply told there's a lot of parallels to today's world, you know, whether you're a Jewish immigrant or a Muslim immigrant, you know, just, and I don't know, I just found it very striking and really resonated. So,
all right, good timing to bring it back. A Bookshop in Berlin by Françoise Frankl. And Jan, your first nonfiction pick.
Well, since I was talking about poetry earlier, I'm gonna talk about a new biography of Elizabeth Bishop, who is also one of my very favorite poets and who I would be glad to show poems to if you come into Prairie Lights.
All right.
And she had a very, she died in 1979, and she was not as famous by any means as she is now. She was sort of considered a poet's poet. She had won the Pulitzer Prize, but her reputation has just sort of become much larger than it was when she died. And she was very private. She had a really very sad life. And so it was years after she died before there was a biography, and now there have been many. Mm. And she was born in Nova Scotia, and her father died when she was 6 months old, and then her mother had a mental breakdown and was institutionalized when Elizabeth was five and never came out. And her relatives never let her see her mother again. And then it's sort of like Heidi. She's taken to her wealthy grandparents in Massachusetts, where she becomes so depressed and upset. And some of her later poems go back and talk about the depression that she suffered as a child in a very interesting way, very interesting. But so she has to be taken back to Nova Scotia, where she can sort of thrive in the summers. And anyway, she went to Vassar. She worked for the Library of Congress. She spent almost 20 years in Brazil, and ended up, she had a small trust fund and never had to work. She could only write. I mean, she was allowed, I mean, she was able to support herself until after the war, and the money didn't mean what it had meant. And so she went to Brazil. And when she came back from Brazil, she taught at Harvard. So she did have a teaching career that didn't begin until she was in her 50s.
Fascinating.
And this of the, probably I've read three or four biographies of her, and I think this one, which is by Thomas Travisano, does the best job of interweaving the work and the life.
All right. Love Unknown, The Life and Worlds of Elizabeth Bishop by Thomas Travisano. And Hunter, your first nonfiction pick.
So I got The Furious Hours by Casey Sepp, which is equal parts true crime and literary biography. And it tells the kind of the story of the case that Harper Lee was writing about, and sort of being billed as Harper Lee's In Cold Blood. And so Casey goes through and gives what was going on with that case, and you'll learn a lot about the life insurance industry. And then the sort of the second half of the book goes, and you learn a lot more about Harper Lee and why Harper Lee didn't end up writing about the case and kind of all the struggles that she had with the success of To Kill a Mockingbird and then having to kind of follow that up. So it's sort of if you want, you know, if it has a little bit of everything for, you know, if you to the true crime readers and then also people that would be more interested in learning about Harper Lee.
Oh, fascinating. Furious Hours by Casey Sepp. And Tim, back to you.
The next one is another memoir called How We Fight for Our Lives by Saeed Jones. It covers, he's only 33 years old, Saeed. He has a book of poetry before this. It covers his years between 12, his ages of 12 till about 25. It is so superbly written that it will spoil you for the next book you read after this because the writing is fantastic. And a memoir really that doesn't deal with the dates and the births and deaths and that sort of thing, but deals with those tiny moments when our perspective is changed. For example, he and his mother hear on the radio about a man named Bird who was chained to the back of a pickup and dragged by white supremacists and was killed. And it's the first time as a 12-year-old that he realized the world was maybe not safe for a young black man. And so he spends that night curled up in his bed in a fetal position, just scared of the world. And whether you're black or white, I mean, we've all been children and known that the world could be a scary place. So he deals with he comes home. He's staying with his grandmother. He comes home and his grandmother has found pictures of shirtless men that he's clipped out of a magazine. And his whole relationship with his grandmother changes at that time. So it's really those moments when he is coming to terms with being a black gay man in this world. It is brutally honest. There are graphic sexual depictions in it. So the book is not for everyone. But if you do read it, you will be rewarded with superb writing and some incredible insight.
How We Fight for Our Lives, a memoir by Saeed Jones. And Jan, you and Hunter have a pick in common on your list. So why don't you can start and then Hunter can kind of finish. But why don't you guys tell me about Make It Scream, Make It Burn by Leslie Jamison?
Well, they're essays and she is it's her second collection of essays. She has an essay collection called The Empathy Exams. She also has a memoir and a novel. But she's sort of really good at researching these really bizarre things and then writing essays about them. And that was true of The Empathy Exams, and it's also true of this. And so this starts out with an essay about a whale who hears such high-pitched things that it really hears nothing. And it's called 52 Blue, and it's considered the loneliest whale in the world because it can't hear other whales. It's you know, wavelength is different. And all these people that identify with it and write to it. And so she goes, you know, outside of Seattle and researches all this stuff that's been written on this whale, but also reports on all these strange people who are obsessed with the whale because it's the loneliest whale in the world.
Oh, fascinating.
And you know, I'll just say one quick thing and then let Hunter talk. But she talks about the famous Joan Didion essay from the White Album, We Tell Ourselves Stories in Order to Live, and questions, because Joan Didion sort of used that to say that we create mythologies, things that may or may not be true in order to get us through life. And Leslie sort of wants to look at it from the other side, where people think all these really strange things that other people don't believe, but maybe they are true. Like, there's a whole essay about children whose parents believe that the children have had past lives because that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds like a fascinating read. Hunter, what do you want to add about Make It Scream, Make It Burn?
I'll just add that I love Leslie Jameson. I talked about her memoir last year on the show, but I do think that like the essay collections are kind of really where she kind of hits her stride. I loved the Empathy Exams, and then this is kind of back to her original form, and yeah, just mix of kind of criticism and journalism, but then she kind of adds her own insights and stuff to it that are great. There's an essay that I really liked about the a museum that will take anything from anybody, and they just write like a little reason for why they, and it all has to do with a lot of it's stuff that was given to them by like past boyfriends and girlfriends and stuff like that, and it has sentimental value, and so they feel like they can't throw it away, but then it's also something that they don't really need to hold on to, and so then they'll go give it to this museum, and then they'll write a little plaque about the story behind the item, and yeah, it's just. She's
fascinating.
Great.
Mm-hmm. All right. Make It Scream, Make It Burn by Leslie Jameson. A double recommendation, so you know it has to be good. Tim, what's your next pick? And we are in the lightning round now.
This is a visual book, so it's kind of hard to discuss it. It's called Brilliant Maps for Curious Minds, 100 New Ways to See the World by Ian Wright. And they use infographic-style atlases of the world. And it's divided into categories, people, geography, history. And you can look up and see what kind of plugins different countries use, what countries have had the most female leaders in the last 50 years, what country has more of an immigrant population than a native population. So it's just a lot of trivia. And we have this on the counter in the bookstore, and people stand there, couples or friends, will look at it for 20 minutes and talk about all of it. So it's just a book to have leg around for any age, because it's mostly visual. You don't have to be a strong reader for this.
All right. And a great gift book, especially if you don't know someone's taste perfectly well. All right. Brilliant Maps for Curious Minds, 100 New Ways to See the World by Ian Wright. Jan, back to you.
Well, I want to talk about briefly this book called State by Melissa Isaacson, and she's a graduate of the journalism department at the University of Iowa, and she was a sports writer for the Chicago Tribune for a long time and now teaches at Northwestern, but she was also a member of the a girls' high school basketball team after Title IX. It was 1979. Right. I think they started playing in 75, was Title IX.
Right. So it was the first girls' basketball team at her school.
At her school, which was West Nile High in Skokie. And she was 5'2". And this team went to state and became state championships, and they beat the team that had Jackie Joyner on it in East St. Louis.
That's crazy.
It was actually filmed. You can actually watch this, grainy video of that game, and it's just incredible to watch these scrappy kids from Skokie just beat these kids in East St. Louis. It's quite amazing.
And it is a great book.
I had Melissa on the show not that long ago to talk about it.
State by Melissa Isaacson. All right, Hunter, back to you.
I'll talk about The Late Migrations by Margaret Rankle. And this is a kind of a mix of grief memoir, but then nature writing. And the author talks about the grief that she experiences from losing her father, and then also 9 years later when she loses her mother. And then she also kind of gives observations of her mother's grief in the 9 years after her father's passing. And then the whole time, intermixed, it's her just observations from the nature. She grew up in Alabama and then I think lives in Tennessee. But then so it's, just a lot of the stuff, the birds in her backyard and stuff. And then, of course, there's a lot of, dying and rebirth and stuff in nature. And she talks about her kids a lot. And it's just very moving.
All right. Late Migrations by Margaret Rankle. And Tim, your next one.
The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator by Timothy C. Weingard. Now, I picked this up because, of course, I'm familiar with mosquitoes, but I wouldn't read this in the summer because it's too scary. You have to read it in the winter, and it will make you thankful for Iowa winters because we have a shorter mosquito season. So you'll be glad when it's, 0 degrees out and there's no mosquitoes. And it's really just how mosquitoes, even before people knew that mosquitoes were causing these illnesses, where they just thought it was bad air, but how would it influence military campaigns, geography, even the slave trade? Sickle cell is a mutation from thousands of years ago to fight off mosquitoes because it's harder for the disease to get into sickle cells rather than round cells. So, I mean, he's a veteran of the Canadian Armed Forces, so his thrust is really more history and military. But it is a fascinating way of showing how a little tiny bug can change a lot of the way we see the world and the things that happen in it.
All right, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator by Timothy C. Weingard. And Jan, your turn.
I've got The Body by Bill Bryson, which is his second science book. He's his best-selling short history of nearly everything we still sell hand over fist. But this book just takes you through the entire body, and it's full of these, like, incredible factoids. Like, for instance, did you know that when you sneeze, it is not droplets that emerge, but sort of a sheet that looks like a piece of saran wrap?
Huh. I did not know.
Or that. Or have you ever wondered why people so rarely fall out of bed? I mean, people have to be like really drunk or something to fall out of bed. They just don't, because we slept in trees and we still have this memory of, you know, how important it was for us not to fall out.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So,
gives so you stuff like that throughout the book.
Lots of conversation starters in this book. And I assume Bill Bryson's wry sense of humor is also present throughout.
Yes, it is.
All right. The Body by Bill Bryson. And Hunter, I think probably this is your last pick, but what have you got?
In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado. And it's a memoir when she kind of details her experiences of being in a same-sex relationship, like psychological abusive relationship, primarily with like psychological abuse. And she just takes kind of every instance and then tries to analyze it from all angles and kind of figure out how it is affecting her today and how it changed, like affected her and who, like after she left the relationship to where she got to do today. And so she's sort of like kind of working through her trauma and trying to see how those instances in the past affect who you are today. And then it kind of also goes into like the history of how same-sex relationships are portrayed in the media and stuff like that. And but it's just, you know, if you read like it's not a happy book necessarily, but it's sort of like if you read, you know, Educated and stuff like that. And it would be kind of those same readers.
All right. So definitely we can learn something. In the Dream House, Carmen Maria Machado. And we are pretty much out of time. So I'm going to just share your final titles, everybody, without any commentary. But you can find these lists on our website, iowapublicradio.org, toward the end of the day with a little bit of commentary along with them. Hunter, your last pick was also Collected Schizophrenias by Esme Weijun Wong. So we'll find out more about that later on. And Tim, I know you had also picked How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real World Problems by Randall Monroe. Sounds like another conversation starter there. And your final one, Jan, The History of Philosophy by A.C. Grayling. So we can spend the winter thinking, right?
Right.
Thank you all so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We had Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City and Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. And again, this list will go up on our website later today at Iowa Public Radio. And we'll talk about books for young readers tomorrow. I'm Charity Nebbie.